Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:36 p.m. Chair Gatto is present today, and he has asked if I would please run the meeting for him. So, present today, we have myself, Representative Thompson, Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Grunberg, Representative Holmes, and Chairman Gatto. First, I'd like to remind everybody to please turn off your cell phones. Turning them to vibrate still interferes with the recording equipment. Okay, we have two bills today which will be heard in this order. Senate Bill 82, Foster Care, Licensing, and State Custody, and House Bill 269, Common Interest Communities. First up is House Bill CS for CS for SS for Senate Bill 82, HSS, version R. Senate Bill 82 is an act relating...
You have a question over here.
Yes.
Would they be required to know this without notes?
I think so. I've got to have the entire title. This is an act relating to the procedures of jurisdiction of the Department of Health and Social Services for the care of children who are in state custody, relating to court jurisdictions and findings pertaining to children who are in state custody, and modifying the licensing requirements for foster care. Here today to present the bill is Celeste Hodge. Did I pronounce that right?
Celeste.
Staff to Senator Davis. Celeste, please come to the podium and put yourself on the record, and we'll do a presentation of Senate Bill 82.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Celeste Hodge. I'm the staff to Senator Betty Davis. The bill before you, Senate Bill 82, modifies various provisions in Title 47, which prioritizes the needs of children in state custody. This legislation seeks to achieve permanency for older children in foster care. Permanency for children in OCS custody is best achieved through reunification with the child's parent, or failing that option through adoption or guardianship. If these three options are not available, another form of permanency is through APLA, another planned permanent living arrangement. This bill seeks to make sure the APLA option is not chosen unnecessarily by providing guidelines for both OCS and the court as to when APLA should be used. The entry to state custody, the bill also enables youth to re-enter state custody if they were released to their parents' custody between ages 16 to 18, but those parents are unable or unwilling to care for the child. The presumption to keep siblings together. Although OCS attempts to keep siblings together when they enter foster care, this bill creates a statutory presumption that siblings be placed in the same home when possible, and when such a placement is in the sibling's best interest. When the children cannot be in the same home, this bill requires an OCS supervisor to document in the file the efforts made and the reason for the separation. The early release of custody. When OCS files a motion to release a child from state custody before the custody order expires, this bill requires OCS and the court to take extra steps to ensure that the child and guardian ad litem have ample notice of the motion and that the release is in the child's best interest. The foster home licensing variance process. If a potential foster home cannot meet the building codes required to be licensed, a licensed foster home, this bill will allow a variance to be granted if the home is consistent with construction of other homes in the community and is otherwise a safe environment for the child. And then the streamlining application process for foster parents. If this bill requires that paperwork required for foster parent licensing be streamlined as much as possible. And the bill also includes changes to the statute providing for retention of jurisdiction by a court to make it consistent with last year's or previous year's legislation to extend departmental custody or supervision to age 21. So that's my introduction of the bill, and we do have representation from OCS as well as the Department of Law here to answer technical questions. I also want to add that this bill carries a zero fiscal note. So thank you very much.
All right, committee, any of you have questions for Celeste? Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much for presenting the bill today. I'm concerned about whether siblings need to be kept together. We know that, and you've already discussed that. But are the siblings made aware of where the other sibling is? So I can see where they can get separated, more separated. Maybe one of the sibling placements, both sibling placements don't work out, and then they go to another foster set and another foster set and so on. And so I'm concerned about, I wouldn't want every sibling to become of age and be unable to find the other one because they got lost in the system someplace. Is there anything in the bill that mandates something that would always keep the siblings knowing where each other is?
Doing the best here.
Explain that well, but yeah, I think you know what I'm saying.
Representative Lynn, as I shared, we do have representation from the department, and if I could have them respond to that question, that would be great.
Any further questions for Celeste? Representative Chair Gatto.
Would you say through the vice chair?
Yes.
I have handed the keys over to him. So since he has the keys, I think it's appropriate to refer to him as the chair.
Any further questions of the sponsor? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a policy, and I think it's the general policy of the legislature, not to have short titles. That's very unusual to have a short title. And usually I move to strike those. And we have, there was a bill by Representative Johansson that dealt with electronic stuff, and he originally in state affairs, as those of you who are on state affairs will remember, had a short title, and we took that out on my motion. And I'm wondering if the sponsor would have an objection if we remove section one.
Can I ask a question before that?
Representative Pruitt.
Can I ask why you have a general, and I think this would probably be good for the sponsor to understand how to answer. Why do you have an issue with this short title? Why does, at this particular, why does it matter if she needs to pull that out or not?
Yeah, this is a long-standing kind of a thing. It just clutters up the uncodified titles. Now they do it in Congress. Every bill has a short title. Mm-hmm. And usually there's something cute or something like that, and people are worrying about what the short title is. And we've just tried to keep our statute simple. And that's just been the policy.
So in this case, they're trying to be able to say, well, back when we passed the AFPA, I don't know, you know how they, a lot of times, let's use it really, on the federal, the Health Care Act, the ARPA or whatever, anyways, all the changes that they shorten it. In this case, they may be trying to create a title so that it's easy to refer to in the future. Maybe whether it's in discussion with a social worker or just discussion. We don't want to give them that opportunity to make it a little bit easier for them to refer to it.
If I may respond. This is a bill that basically amends existing statutes. And it's not like the creation of a whole new act or a whole new title or something like that. It's simply amending existing statutes. It also implies that right now we don't protect foster families. I'm using this as an example. Right. It sort of says like this is the Alaska Foster Family Protection Act, when all it does is, I'm not downgrading what it does because I think I strongly support it, but it basically strengthens some additional existing statutes. And if in fact we were, let's say for the purpose of discussion, to create a dam, then I could see calling something the Susitna Dam Act or something like that, but this is not that kind of a thing. I think we have occasionally passed something, but this is just generally been our policy here.
Right. No, I appreciate the explanation. Thank you.
And I would ask Ms. Hodge.
Through the chair, I'm Representative Weinberg. This bill legislation has been vetted, well vetted with the department Department of Law and the department. And so I'd like to defer with the sponsor as well as those that worked on this bill regarding the title.
Okay, so fine. Yeah, I don't have any problem with you. You want to confer with them. I don't have a problem with that.
Representative Keller.
For the record, we had this in Health and Social Services Committee, and this topic did not come up. So it was not vetted in our committee.
And I do support the bill.
All right. Any further questions of the sponsor? Celeste, thank you very much. We'll open up to public testimony now. I believe in the room, I think we have Christy Lawton, Director of Office of Children's Services. Please place your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Christy Lawton. I'm the director for the Office of Children's Services, and I'm here for questions primarily. This is a bill that we have collaborated on and find that it is going to be in the best interest of the children that we serve, but I'm happy to entertain any questions on specific practices or details that might be helpful for you.
Questions? Representative Grunberg.
I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Ms. Hodge. How would you feel about the elimination of Section 1?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the title, I think, in terms of day-to-day practice for caseworkers makes no difference. The law is the law. I don't think from their own perspective, when they're thinking about what they're doing and why, they're thinking about specific law titles. For example, they're just thinking about 4710, which is the primary statute that we go by.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask all the other witnesses the same question.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra also, who is knowledgeable of the bill. Go right ahead, Representative Grunberg.
That was my only question.
Any further questions?
Just for the information of Representative Guerra, I had raised the issue on Section 1, and I know Ms. Hodge is conferring, and I'm sort of asking all the other witnesses. And maybe at some point, Representative Guerra could weigh in on that question. I don't want to delay the bill or anything, but...
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your testimony.
Actually, sorry.
Oh,
she's here.
Pardon? A question? Representative Holmes.
So the department is supportive of that. What does the department have an official position?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Holmes. Much of what is in the bill is practice that we believe is best practice for children and families. Some of these items are things that we were already contemplating changing in policy, as well as some of the items are supported through the Fostering Connections Act that was passed several years ago that states are already required. So this really helps to support and bring further, I guess, enforcement and authority to these provisions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Representative Pruitt has a question.
One question based on that. You said these were potentially things you were going to change in policy. Do we limit your ability in the future to change certain things or be able to adjust as you guys feel necessary without having to come back to us with the legislation as it's in front of us?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I don't think that any of these provisions, in terms of the kinds of things that we might want to enhance or further develop in policy, this would prohibit us from making those changes. Much of what we change in policy stems from federal guidance that comes out, so I don't think that would be a problem.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Christy, for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to the off-net. Amanda, are you there from Anchorage?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Please place your name and affiliation on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
For the record, my name is Amanda McKeever, and I'm the statewide coordinator of an organization called Facing Foster Care in Alaska. I'm also an alumni of the foster care system. I age out of foster care here in Anchorage, and I'm currently a student in the School of Social Work, a master's student at UAA. I'd like to first thank the committee for hearing this bill and for allowing time for testimony. I'm calling on behalf of Facing Foster Care in Alaska in support of Senate Bill 82. This bill would do a number of things to improve the lives of youth currently in foster care and those who come into the system after them. It sounds like most of you are pretty savvy to each provision, so I'm just going to highlight a few things. this bill proposes to keep siblings together, and the Fostering Connections Act also currently does that, but we do, I know there was a question earlier from, I believe it was Representative Lynn, see young people that are still being separated even when they come into foster care, and though they might get continued contact, that might look like a 15-minute phone call once a week to talk to your brother who's in a different community if you're living in Southeast Alaska. So this proposes to keep young people together as soon as they come in the system and ensuring that they continue to stay together and aren't separated. And I also oftentimes see siblings separated, older siblings separated from their younger siblings because maybe they've played the role of a parent for a long time, and the caseworker or whoever's working the case sees that, you know, that older sibling needs to have time to be a child, but not only are they being removed from their parents, it's almost like they're having their own child separated from them if they have younger siblings that are separated from them. The bill also proposes to loosen up licensing standards for rural communities. So oftentimes young people who are in more rural areas, homes in those communities can't get licensed for children once they come into custody to stay in those communities. And an example of this is I know a number of young people who are from the Bethel area who are currently placed in the Mountain Valley, and I met a young lady actually last week who's from Alakanuk who was placed in a foster home in Palmer because there weren't any homes in her community. And that home didn't work out because the foster family was actually vegetarian, and she was kind of in the middle of nowhere and didn't have access to meat. But then she recently actually came to Anchorage, and now she lives in Anchorage and has for a little while and doesn't want to return back to her home community. So what happens is young people come into urban areas and then don't ever return to their home community where they came from. And then the most, I think is the most important provision of this bill is with regard to APLA, which stands for Another Planned Permanent Living Arrangement. And this is the permanency goal that young people get when adoption, guardianship, and reunification are no longer an option, or the caseworker doesn't see them, or the team doesn't see them as options anymore. And especially it's long-term foster care, and it's the goal that young people get when they age out of the system. And the number of young people 15 and 16, what I see in practice is they sort of almost automatically get this goal, and the expectation is that they'll start working on independent living and life skills and start working toward whatever it is they need to be independent. And I know that last year the legislature was really wonderful in passing a number of things for those young people that age out in terms of funds for higher education and housing assistance and things like that. But we can give youth all the money and resources in the world, but they're not going to make it on their own unless they have a supportive adult in their life. So young people can leave care with free college tuition and housing, but they still need somebody to call if they get a flat tire, if they don't know how to cook something. When they have their own children, they need somebody to be grandparents to their kids, and they need somebody to walk them down the aisle when they get married and those kinds of things. And so I think this just really emphasizes the need to focus on permanency for young people and not give up on them just because they're teenagers. And I know a number of young people at this point, we've sort of seen an influx of youth who've been in care for 5, 10, 15 years. And what we see when they age out is they move into other social service systems or the justice system. And so this not only saves money for the state from having young people move into different systems, but it also helps them in that they get a family and a connection to adult that'll be there forever. So that's my testimony. I'll stay on if there's questions.
Thank you, Amanda. Out of curiosity, this is just from a personal side. Back in about 1961, when I was in high school, one of my best friends all the way through high school turned 18 when he was a junior in high school. The foster family that he had lived with for 12 years no longer got a check, so they said goodbye, and he was kicked out halfway through junior year in high school. And so he came to my house and stayed with me till he graduated. Wonderful kid, wonderful guy, and wonderful man now. But is there any arrangements that are in place that where you take care of somebody that's still in high school and it turns 18 and opts out, or they're out of the system? What do you do there?
Well, currently, foster care can now be extended to 21 for young people who opt to stay in, and the state can actually keep young people in from the age of 18 to 19, and they usually do that if they haven't yet graduated high school, so they still have that stable living environment, and then also now young people have an option to re-enter foster care. So if they leave at 18, if they want out of the system and they become homeless or at risk of economic economic hardship, they can come. They can opt to come back into state custody, and so that's actually something. All that stuff passed last year, and so obviously it was obvious there's a need for additional support for young people. But even at 21, I mean, you have to have a plan in place, because I know some foster parents will say you're done when that check finishes. But I know even in my experience, my foster parents allowed me to stay in their home until I was 22. So I stayed in 2 years beyond my time that custody expired. But the agreement was, if I was in college, then I could stay. So
that's good news to hear. Thank you. Representative Holmes has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not really a question so much. It's just I wanted to voice appreciation for all the hard work that Amanda puts in on these issues. I know she puts her heart and soul into it, and I just wanted to thank her for. Thanks, Amanda, for all your hard work.
Thanks.
Representative Keller.
I'd like to ditto that, if you don't mind. in the House Committee and have Social Services, Health and Social Services Committee, Amanda has been a very active player. That was a lot of hours. I would dare say more hours than the sponsor, but maybe not. Yeah, I mean, that's no reflection on the sponsors. It's just that I know, Amanda, you've been working on this hard, and you must feel really good about it moving forward.
I hope we move forward.
So do we.
Any further questions of Amanda? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else online or in the room that would like to testify on House or Senate Bill 82? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony, and that brings the bill back before the committee for discussion. Representative Grunberg.
On page, and maybe this is for Ms. Hodge or the Representative Gower or somebody, on page 3, line 16 and 17, looking the way that's supposed to read, in addition to the extensions of state custody ordered by a court under another section, a court may grant a hearing on resuming state custody up until the person's 21st birthday. If the person, and these are all conjunctive because of the word and at the end of line 27, if they were placed out of home care, by the department immediately before being released from state custody, and the person is in need of out-of-home care, because the person is completing an educational or vocational program. I think I hadn't read it properly, but I gather that the reason for that is they would then be able to put them in a foster home, and so they could be getting education. And it's just a very benign principle. Is that right? Yeah. The witnesses are nodding yes. So I don't have a problem with that.
No further question on that, or you need her to come up and...
No. I just wanted to put... It was a long serpentine kind of the way the thing's written, and I wanted to be... I was confused, and I'm no longer confused.
Okay.
At least on that
point. At least on that point.
Not confused.
I'll reserve the right to be confused on other things.
Is there any other further questions from the sponsor, from the committee? Representative Grunberg.
I was going to go back to my question on Section 1 and ask Ms. Hodgson and Representative Garrett, too, with both of them, what their feelings on that are.
Representative Garrett, could you place yourself on the record?
Or you, either one, I don't
know. You're going to answer Representative Grunberg's question.
Representative Lascara, District 23. Representative Grunberg, it's certainly up to the committee. I like to sometimes have a name for a bill, especially because, and if you're in this business long enough, people come up to you with bill numbers, and you have no idea what the bill number was, but you'll remember what your bill was. And
41?
Yeah. That one I remember. And I think, I think the title accurately reflects what the bill does, but with that, it's certainly up to the committee.
I would just ask
a question, Representative Grunberg,
if you wanted to say anything.
Celeste Hodge, for the record, ditto.
I'm not going to do anything that the sponsors don't endorse.
Okay.
If they endorsed it, I'd do it, but otherwise, I'm not.
All right. Back to the committee. Any further questions? Discussion.
Good bill.
If not, I would entertain a motion.
Do I have to say it all then? How about a House CS for Senate CS for Senate sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 82 S with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note. I move that to committee.
And that is version 27-LS-0500/R?
Romeo, yes.
Correct. Any objection? Seeing none, we passed Senate Bill 82 from committee, and we'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork.
Thank you.
We're back on the record. Our next and last bill today is House Bill 269, Common Interest Communities. This is an act relating to the amendment of a declaration that creates a common interest community. Here to present the bill is Representative Lindsay Holmes and her staff, James Waldo. And Representative Holmes, are you...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'm going to turn most of it over to James, but just briefly, I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill today. This is a uniform law change that attempts to clean up our statutes having to do with condominium developments and the development of those condominiums. And with that, I'm just going to let James walk us through what the bill does.
Mr. Waldo, place your name on the record and present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Lindsay Holmes. HB 269 is a little bit complicated, but once you get to the bottom of it, it makes a lot of sense. I will try to be brief, and we should have the real expert online to testify about it, Jim McCollum, who's probably worked on, I can't imagine how many development projects in Anchorage and throughout the state in the last several years, and really is knows his stuff on this. But the real quick version of the story is there's a glitch in state law that can cause development projects, specifically condo development projects, to stall out after a certain time window. And this is a problem for both developers, people who work for developers, and the lenders who lend money to developers, as well as condo associations who want to live in fully completed projects rather than ones with empty foundations and piles of dirt laying around them. Fortunately, this problem was recognized by the National Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, and they fixed it in the 1996 amendments to that act, as well as the 2008 amendments to that act. HB 269 quite simply takes that fix from the uniform law and puts it into state law. The slightly longer story is when you develop a condo development, you usually do it in phases. And there's a timeline for you to complete all of those phases. If a developer doesn't finish by the end of that timeline, the undeveloped condos or the partially developed condos revert back to the condo association, and the developer is unable to finish. State law provides for the condo association to allow the developer extra time to finish, which is pretty much in everyone's benefit. The only trick is state law requires a unanimous approval by the condo association, and as everyone in this room knows, unanimous is often very difficult to get to, especially with homeowners associations. And in fact, you could have somebody who's in Arizona at their winter residence who just doesn't vote. That would prevent it from going forward. You could have somebody who just says no to everything, or you could have somebody who just doesn't care enough to respond. And in all of those cases, the project stalls out, and really, everybody loses out. What the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act did, as far as the national change, is lower that threshold from 100% to 80%, which is still a very high threshold and shows very strong support in the community, but is achievable. Developers and homeowners associations can work together to get that timeline extended so that projects can be finished. Everybody keeps working. The developer makes the money on the project they plan to. The lender gets the money out of the project they expected to. And the homeowners association isn't left with, as I said, sort of empty foundations and piles of dirt on one side of their neighborhood. And with that, I would just urge you to support HB 269 and answer any questions you have.
Questions of the sponsor, Representative Grunberg and then Representative Keller.
First of all, Mr. Chair, is Mr. McCollum on the phone?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I will ask Mr. Waldo and Mr. McCollum these questions so, you know, you guys can decide who wants to answer them. I have basically two questions, and they're on page 2. Line 16, the phrase, including 80% of the votes allocated to units not owned by the declarant. Who or what is the declarant?
In in this case, the declarant is the developer that is declaring units ready for sale. So what that essentially says is that if the developer has a certain number of votes within the homeowners association, which is often common in the beginning when they own most of the units, their votes don't count towards extending the timeline. You have to have the actual people living in the units voting.
I'm going to ask some people around here to go through the analysis here. It has the word including on line 15, including 80% of the votes allocated. So it doesn't just... I'm not sure mathematically how that works. You need to have 80% overall. And you need also, it's like a Venn diagram, a circle within a circle. You need to have 80% of the big circle. And also 80% of the small circle, which is defined as those units not owned by the declarant. So even if, let us say that you had 10 units and 8 of them remained owned by the declarant, then to get 80% of the other 2, you'd have to have both of them agree. And I gather that is the intent.
And through the chair, Representative Greenberg, I believe so. Mr. Chairman, I believe Jim McCollum's online, and he can certainly back me up on that and answer in greater depth if Representative Greenberg needs.
Mr. Chair, if that could occur, then I can pass to my second question. Could we ask Mr. McCollum?
Mr. McCollum, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, place your name and affiliation on the record, and Mr. Representative Greenberg had a question for you.
Yeah. Thank you. This is James McCollum. Of the law offices of James McCollum, and through the chair, Representative Greenberg, your analysis was exactly correct. You would have to have the 2 votes, in that case being 80% of the non-declarant owned units, and then you would also have to have 8 out of the 10 as being 80% of the allocated votes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McCollum. By the way, thank you for testifying today, Jim. We appreciate it. If I may pass...
Representative Gatto, is that all right?
Thanks, sure. Mr. Chair. Another question. Is this 80% of the value of the homes or 80% of the acreages that the homes occupy? Or 80% of what number?
Chair Gatto, through the chair, I believe that's 80% of the units in the association, so the number of residences. And again, Jim McCollum online can answer in more specificity if you need.
Follow-up question, Representative Gatto.
Well, for Jim McCollum, I'm a little curious about how that's allocated. I know in the Palmer area, we have LIDs, local improvement districts. And in the local improvement districts, you want to run power, gas, whatever. You have to have both. 80% of the value of the property plus 80% of the property itself. So that's something that needs to be decided up front. I bet it is. It's just that we're not on it.
Mr. McCollum, do you have an answer for Representative Gatto?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Gatto. Under the Uniform Act as adopted in Alaska, there are a number of different formulas for allocating votes. And in some cases, probably the majority, is one vote per unit, but that is not always the case. There are cases where the primary other method is by square footage in the unit, so that one unit might have a higher percentage than another, and so you could obtain your 80% through it might not be the same as 80% of the units. So that's why it says 80% of the votes. So it's voting by percentage. In some cases, their percentages are equal. In other cases, they are not.
Well, the issue we had was running a mainline extension for natural gas. And there was the first year, everybody was gung-ho until you had to start paying your taxes on it. And, of course, they had enough. But ultimately, when it came time to paying taxes, they also knew that you could rely on, if I dropped out, all you other guys would have to make up for me leaving the pool, which was quite encouraging to some people. So we need to settle this. That was for the valley, and we understand that. But whatever the districts are, is it, you know, it's usually a subdivision. It all worked well in the end, but made some bitter feelings. Because in that first year, people just said, well, they're here to start digging. And we said, sign here to enter into this LID, Local Improvement District. And they said, we don't have to. And they were absolutely right. They did not have to. So we didn't get the gas line, so we kept paying high rates. Next year they got the gas line because they understood that it was not a bogus threat. It was a real threat. Mm. So they could look back at their tax bill and see that you don't have to buy it, but if you don't, the value of your property is essentially heading down. So, I don't mind whichever way to do it, but is there a formula that the association can adopt that says, once it looks like you're in it, because you have 100,000 units, I don't know what we had, then I thought it was sort of like cheating. As soon as you run past my property, and I said, hold on, you're messing with my tax bill. So can we get that settled on the record?
And ask the sponsor, Representative Holmes.
Should we have Mr. McCollum there?
I think to reinterpret, James R. Waldo, staff to Representative Holmes, to reinterpret what James McCollum just indicated is that it is settled up front in the documents for each condo association, how the votes are going to be allocated. Typically, the votes are allocated on one per unit basis, although in other cases, they are allocated based on how much square footage there is in a unit. But it's settled up front, and everybody knows what it is.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, this is my first look at condo law. Right on the surface here, but has some basic questions. Is a declaration always part of a construction project? Is that the only thing a declaration is for a construction project?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, as I understand it, declarations are usually what create the project or create the condo association, but again, James McCollum really is the expert, and I think he would best answer that question.
But let me go ahead. I want to, if it's okay with the chair,
Representative
several
Keller.
That I just want to string on, because I'm sure that James or James will have comments.
One of the James.
And I'm glad you're online. My basic question is just how far can these changes intrude into a person's life? As I look down on page 2, line 10 there, it's talking about restricting the permitted uses of the property or behavior in the property or the number of people in the whole unit. So, I mean, the impression I'm getting is that we have residents of a condo and maybe they're putting a new roof on the whole unit or something like that. And in the process of this, just to give you a scenario that came to my mind that maybe you could speak to, smoking has lost popularity over a number of years here. So as part of that project, could there be a declaration that there will be no more use of these units for smoking? So a person that is a order, see, the question has to do with how far does this go in actually intrusion? Can it go to the point of intruding in people's lives and their choices and being unaware? Is it, that's probably the reason why it was 100%, maybe. You know, I'm just kind of struggling with this whole thing.
And through the chair, Representative Kelly, I think Jim McCollum would be the best to answer that because he really knows the true nitty-gritty specifics on it. I would say that lines 7 through 12 there, paragraph F, is not the main thrust of the bill. The main thrust of the bill is subsection G, 13 through 20. But again, I think Jim McCollum could best tell you how those uses might be restricted under the declaration.
Just a clarification, subsection F is a new,
it is new.
Subsection that added to this bill. Whether it's major or not, it's very major if it does something that we don't want it to do, right? Absolutely.
Well, I get Mr. McCollum on. Mr. McCollum, are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, did you hear Representative Keller's question?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Keller. You're exactly correct. It can change the use restrictions on the unit. The drafters of the act, the people who wrote this act, changed it after a lot of national experience, which convinced them that 80% was adequate to protect those interests, because even getting 80% is extremely difficult. And so that's why they changed the act nationally. They found that when we had it at 100%, we virtually assured that nothing could ever change, because getting 100% of the people, some of these projects have hundreds of units. It only took one person to block it, and one of the oddities of the act, which they pointed out, was that you could terminate a condominium, and you can under Alaska law, with an 80% vote. So you could literally terminate the condominium, sell off the buildings with an 80% vote, but you couldn't change the use restrictions or extend the development rights. And so to bring these things more in line while still providing substantial protection, their feeling was that 80% was an adequate number. Our experience, and we're working on a project right now that Bob Peterson may address if he testifies, I assume he will, that we've been working at this for 4 or 5 months, and I think we've just finally gotten over 50% of the people to respond, to even respond, much less vote yea or nay. And so the problem was with 100% that you effectively couldn't do anything. And even at 80%, from experience, I can tell you it's going to be very difficult to do anything. So I think there always is a balance. There's a lot of literature about this. When you buy into these common interest communities, which are becoming increasingly common, of balancing the interest of the project versus that of a single individual, it's a balancing point. And I think the thought was that 80% is so difficult to get that was adequate to protect people from sort of the tyranny of the majority. I hope that answers your question. I'm not sure if I did.
Keller has a follow-up question for you.
Just a comment, unless you want to expand on that, really leaves me with a lot of concern, because I think one may be appropriate if you're talking about basic property rights and what you do in your property. I've got a ways to go. I'm thinking that one through, but my knee jerk, and again, my first delve into condo law here, is that it may be very appropriate for one person to be able to protect his own property rights and say no.
I have to make a comment too, then, because if you have a large group in a condo association and they want to make sure that somebody doesn't have their rock band practicing till 3 o'clock in the morning, and you have to have 100% vote, well, the one that's got all the noise going on could vote no, and then you don't have any ordinance to try to make it so you can sleep at night. So there are two sides to that argument, I think. Go ahead, Mr.
Well, through the chair, the problems that I have seen, admittedly, I don't see everything, and I've talked to attorneys that represent associations, are more of the latter type. We haven't seen up here people trying to create unreasonable restrictions on people. It's been more the case where you have one individual ruining life for a whole bunch of people, and it's not covered. Amazingly, people seem to come up with ways to do things that aren't always covered by our rules. And so in order to change the rules to make everybody's life livable, we just couldn't do it. Admittedly, it does work both ways, but I can tell you that just from experience, if you could get 80% to even vote, much less vote in favor of something, you've got very broad support.
Representative Greenberg, question of the sponsor or Mr. McCollum?
Yeah, I own two condos, one that we have here in Juneau that we live in during the session, and one where I used to live a number of years ago, now it's rented out, and I asked the folks in charge of both associations and the professional property manager for one of those to weigh in on the bill if they had any objection, and I didn't hear anything. So I don't know if that's inertia or what. You probably couldn't get them to agree that the sun rises in the east, I suspect. But my next question related to the last sentence in the bill, beginning on page 2, line 17. And it sounds like the agreement to allow development to be extended is effective 30 days after the amendment to make the change is recorded, unless all persons holding special declarant rights that are affected by the amendment or security interests in those rights record an objection in writing within the 30-day period. In which case the thing is void, the amendment, or consent in writing when the amendment is recorded to a different date, in which case the amendment is effective when recorded. That change would seem to get away from the 80% requirement, because let us say for the purpose of discussion, 80% agree to a change, but they don't want it to be effective 30 days, they want it to be effective immediately or another date. That change, anything varied from the 30 days on line 17, must be 100% recorded. Couldn't that just allow one person to stymie this part of it? And I guess Representative Holmes was shaking her head.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, and I don't believe that's correct, and I think James can help me out if I falter here, but special declarant rights are not the 80%. The special declarant rights are the developers. And so I think what this section is basically saying is the condo owners have to vote by at least 80% to extend the rights, but then all of the developers actually have to agree as well that they want the rights extended. So this gives them the ability, gives them 30 days to object, or they can just, all the developers, all the people who own these special declarant rights could sign right away saying, yes, we agree. Because otherwise the homeowners could sort of force the developer to extend even if the developer didn't want to extend.
Oh, okay. The second question is, it says on the last word of line 19, or security interests. So presumably, the developers could all agree, but the bank that holds the security interest could stop the whole thing. Is that the intent, too?
Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so. I will defer to Mr. McCollum, but I believe that this would allow either the bank or the developers to say, no, we actually aren't planning to extend.
We have other people online. Also, we have Joe Beadle from the Alaska Bankers Association, Bob Peterson from the Peterson Group that are going to testify today also.
Okay. I can see that there are maneuvers and financial dealings and stuff here that I couldn't even begin to imagine. And I'll assume that the people who have interest in these have all been at the table, so I'm not going to go any further, but I can see great games if you're a gamesman. I'll leave it at that.
Any further questions from committee members for the sponsor? For Mr. Waldo? Seeing none, then we'll go to public testimony. Mr. McCollum, you've been talking already, answering questions. Did you have further testimony on House Bill 269?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The only comment I had was as to the last point that was raised. What happens on the typical condo project now is you have one tract of land, and once the very first units are sold, the only thing that the developer holds in that, the only title they hold in the property is this development right. And the only collateral that the lender holds is the development right. And so these development rights are sometimes worth millions of dollars. They're the sole collateral of the bank. So the sole purpose of those lines starting about 17 is to preclude the association by itself from changing the ownership interest of the declarant without the declarant's consent and without his lender's consent. And I think Joe Beadle, who is also going to testify, can confirm how important that is.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McCollum. Any questions? Further questions of Mr. McCollum at this time? Seeing none, then we'll move on to also at the Anchorage LIO is Bob Peterson, Peterson Group. Are you there, Mr. Peterson?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, place your name and affiliation on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
I'm Bob Peterson, and I'm affiliated with the Peterson Group. We're a building and development firm in Anchorage, Alaska. Our company has been building in Alaska for nearly 30 years. And we built the first condominium project with the new Uniform Commercial Interest Ownership Act in 1995, which was down in Girdwood, Alaska. And since we've incorporated over a dozen projects in the municipality of Anchorage, comprising over 1,000 homes. So I'm quite familiar with the Uniform Commercial Interest Ownership Act and how homeowners associations and homeowners and their boards deal with the use restrictions and rules that come with those. And it's been my experience, having had been the president of all of these associations, is that in numerous cases there's been use restrictions that have been recorded with the declaration that require 100% unanimous vote to change, and there was rational reasons to make changes. However, the consensus was it would take an act of Congress to get everyone to agree, and it was an idea left behind, which actually may have made a lot of sense relative to parking or pets or some other reasonable issue. Now, the reason I'm testifying for the most part is because development rights, which are also regulated by the declaration and are limited to 7 or possibly 10 years, just don't give the declarant or the developer enough time to finish a project when there's a poor economy, which is what we've been in for about 5 years now. I'll give you a good example. We have a beautiful project in Anchorage called Summerstone. It's it's 164 homes. We finished 160 of those homes in the first 7 years. Our declaration rights expired, and the last four homes can't be completed and sold because we no longer have declarant rights to do so. Summerstone Board of Directors completely favors allowing us more time to finish so that we can include and incorporate those units into their association. The benefit to them is, one, if the project is completed as it was contemplated and people had expected. Secondly, those last four units will contribute to dues, which are important to the viability of the association and, of course, the overall look. So a proxy was sent out to the 160 current homeowners. We're on the second proxy now. Approximately half have responded. There's been 79 votes in favor, one not in favor. So we're done, unless we can convince this one protractor and the other 80 people who haven't voted yet to vote. It's just not a reasonable situation. It's rational to move forward with changing the declaration so that these sorts of things can be facilitated. I hope you pass this bill to rectify this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the committee for Mr. Peterson? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Peterson. We'll go now to OffNet. We have Joe Beadle calling in from Anchorage. Joe, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please place your name and affiliation on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joe Beadle. I'm president of the Alaska Bankers Association and president of North Rim Bank. I am speaking today in favor of House Bill 269. By way of background, all eight banks in the Alaska Bankers Association unanimously agree to support this legislation. The concept of people thinking about condominiums, oftentimes they think of the vertical type, the high-rise condos. Just a reminder to everyone, as already represented by Mr. Peterson, these are townhouse and developments, and a couple of representatives on the committee are familiar with, like the Clearwater condominium project. It's a townhouse layout, and it is in concert with Seahawk, Cook Inlet Housing Association. And the concept of many developments to use higher density property in communities and to absorb costs of lands and to absorb costs of amenities. You know, we look for affordable housing through using less land and having more amenities. And so condos are important for the future, but I will say this, as a bank and banks in general, they're not easy to do. They're not easy for the declarant, the developer, the contractor. They're not easy for the bank. They're not easy for the association and for the buyers. There's all kinds of standards that people have to abide by. And so the governance that goes on is important. This UKIA, this uniform code that addresses us now becoming in compliance with at least this section of the national uniform statute will help us. People talk about what could we change, and really the best practice is to say let's use the uniform compliance, and then people like Alaska Housing and Housing Authorities and Fannie and Freddie and FHA all use the same standards to understand what it takes to move, what it takes to change the declarant, to extend the time frame for projects. Time is the essence for us as a bank as well, as already described by legal counsel. And we are involved currently with eight projects. So we, being North Rim Bank, we have about 50% of the market share in Anchorage, Alaska. And I can tell you that that we're approaching and have approached and potentially will pass limits of time to complete developments and create hardships for current associations that then have undeveloped property and burdens to do something with it. So changing this then will allow the vote to occur in its normal format allowed under UKIA. So absorption in commercial properties, in residential properties in particular, in condominiums has slowed. And so this slowing of the absorption of purchase of property have brought us up to this point where we need a solution. And so as the Bankers Association, we recommend approval and certainly for us to consider future projects. And unless we do, we will probably be even more challenged to make uniform common interest property loans. So we recommend approval for the benefit of housing for the entire state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for Mr. Beadle? Seeing none, Mr. Beadle, I thank you very much for your testimony today. Is there anyone else that would like to provide public testimony to House Bill 269? Anybody in the room or anybody else online? Seeing none, then public testimony is closed. The bill's back before the committee for discussion. Are there any further questions, Mr. Waldo, or the sponsor, Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Keller.
Is the Department of Law looked at? I'm concerned about a constitutional issue. I'm just going to talk a little bit about this, and you let me respond. But subparagraph F. It really bothers me because a person can own a piece of property and then can be told later that his use or behavior in that property is not appropriate, totally out of the person's control, and it's after the fact. Now, I have no problem with a person that buys a condo agreeing to that before he buys, you know, that his behavior and use of this property may be changed by even a majority vote. In other words, you can give your rights away, but I think what we're talking about is almost an inherent right, you know, on this property value issue. And I would like to hear from the Department of Law from that. I don't want to slow your bill down, so I'm also open to if you want to take that section out, you know. But otherwise, I would request, you know, some kind of feedback here from about the constitutional questions that I have. Get a legal opinion or two and just see what it is, you know, because I have some concerns that I you know, can't show off.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we did have discussion earlier on, and Mr. Waldo can help me fill in, and maybe Mr. McCollum, because we were looking at some of the constitutional amendments of the idea that this would change a threshold vote to make it different from what it was when you bought in to the program. So, in other words, I'm somebody to go in and buy into a condo unit, and when I buy in, it says you need 100% threshold to make these changes, and then now it says you only need 80%. And we actually did run that by our legal drafters, and the answer is that under the bill as written, this 80% threshold does not go in automatically. What has to happen is that the condo association has to actually vote to amend their rules to this just authorizes a condo association to have an 80%. This would not mandate it. So in other words, if I'm an existing condo association that has an 80%, that has 100, let me try that again. For any new condo association, they can specify in their bylaws the 80%. Right now, they don't even have the right to do that. But for those that are existing, I believe they would have to actually amend their documents, which would have to go through their normal process for amending their documents in order to change the threshold. It would not be automatically imposed.
And Representative Kelly, through the chair, I would echo what Representative Holmes said. In discussions with Jim McCollum, part of the answer really was, if you look to line 8 there, the latter half of it, it says, or a larger percentage specified in the declaration. And you have to think of the declaration sort of as the constitution of a condo association. And so currently, if your declaration says, we need a unanimous vote because that's what state law requires us to have, is a unanimous vote to restrict, to have a use restriction, then to change that, to scale it back to 95% or 90% or 80% would require an amendment of that declaration, which is a process the condo association would have to go through. Then they would scale it back, and then they could begin discussing use restrictions at that 80% level. So these processes are already sort of set up. It's just state law has tied their hands previously, and now we're allowing them greater latitude to determine how they want to run their condo association.
I will probably, through the chair, to the sponsor, I will probably propose an amendment to get rid of the section. Your analogy between the condo agreement and the Constitution is interesting because, as you know, the process to change our Constitution is rather rigorous. And I would defy you to prove that it's a rigorous process with a condo association. I just don't know how it is, you know. And it probably varies from agreement to agreement. And I think this is fundamental core stuff, you know, it really is. You know, you mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair, about the band playing loudly. You know, that's when we live together, we have problems like that. And we have issues like that. And there's other laws, like disturbing the peace or whatever we rely on. If you have two houses that are close to each other, I happen to unenjoy my neighbor's music, you know, every now and then, and I'm not even that close. We have a rural place. But I mean, there's other things in place. But the right to how you use your own property and what you do in your own property is really, really fundamental. And I, you know, I'm still kind of squirming, and I'd hate to get into the point where we define the process for how a condo agreement, that really sounds dry, you know, is changed. But you know, it seems to me like there is no guide. There probably are guidelines, but they're probably hard to discover and probably not followed all that closely. So I have concerns with that section. Anyway, I think I've documented that all right.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and of course I'm definitely sensitive to the issue, and that's why we did raise the constitutional issues. Obviously, there is the right to the many, the right to the few, all of this, and the 80% threshold in my mind is such a high threshold, especially given the fact that it's so hard to get everybody to even show up. I mean, we get overwhelming vote totals, and it's like 30% of citizens show up to vote. We consider it to be a landslide, you know. So even getting 80% of the people to show up, I think, is challenging enough. So I have satisfied myself that an 80% threshold's high enough, especially given that this is all subject. That's just what is allowed by law. It is not mandated on any condo association that chooses that they want to have 100%. Is very free to do so. This is simply setting the option for condo associations, and there are mechanisms within their own world. So I'm definitely very sensitive to this. This is something we went around and around with Ledge Legal to be sure that we were on good legal ground and there were procedures. So
my understanding is that for a condo association to change it to 80%, they're going to need 100% of the vote to approve changing it to 80%. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to Jim McCollum on that for the process of how condo associations amend their declarations. Mm-hmm. But I would also point out, just to piggyback on Representative Holmes' comment, to amend our own state constitution requires two-thirds in both the House and the Senate, which is roughly 66%, well below an 80% threshold. Whereas this would require 80% essentially of the voting population, which again, isn't just 80% of turnout, but 80% of every possible voter out there.
You understand
that, Keller.
What the chair is asking, though, is it's a threshold of how to get this in place. Yes. You know, in other words, if it's 100% of the vote to amend the agreement, and that is uniform. That really shoots my concerns in the foot. Also,
I would defer to Mr. McCollum.
Mr. McCollum, you're on the line.
Yes.
Did you hear the question?
Well, I did. I think there were sort of several questions in there, but the documents that I draft say that it requires 100%. So that's a question that I don't think can be answered short of a court proceeding, whether it takes 100% vote to change the existing documents without going to court. But there are other documents and probably not mine, but that probably don't have a specific requirement for voting changes in use. And so whether those documents would require 100% vote is also a separate question that unfortunately isn't addressed and would have to be addressed by a court. There's also, I will say this, that in looking at some cases in this area, what a lot of courts have done is said that the uses in existence as of the date of the amendment are grandfathered in. Yeah. And actually that, in some instances, where condo associations have changed rules, even around the country where they're not under this act, in order to avoid challenges and to keep the peace, many times they have grandfathered in existing uses. So it's a pretty complex area as to what is going to happen next. But what this act does is at least permits an 80% approval, but does not override the provisions of the condominium documents.
Representative Keller has another question along those lines.
Yeah, just confirming what you said. You said that to be sure that it be 100% to get in the deal would have to take a court decision or evaluation and make come out different places, and the grandfather concept based on case law. And the problem that I have is that there, even though it's a very narrow thing, and I understand that you're only talking, it's hard to get 80% of anything. And I can speak firsthand that 2/3 is tough enough. No problem. But what we're talking about here is a very broad. It's the uses and the behavior in your own property, and it's one of the cornerstones, of our constitutional principles, the property rights are. So I want to err on the side of being cautious here. I'm not trying to be troublesome, but I really have a concern that we want to nail this one down.
Representative Holmes, any replies there?
Yeah, I mean, I understand. I definitely understand the concerns. I definitely understand the concerns. I guess I'm. I think that it's because of the fact that the 80% is just allowed, not mandated, in this, and it's up to the individual condo association to do it. And because I think there are going to be constitutional protections for groups that have already entered into the documents, I think there are a fair number of protections in there. But I am more than willing to keep talking with Representative Keller about this and nail down as many particulars as we can and see if we can't make Representative Keller a little bit more comfortable.
So, any further discussion by the committee? We do have a lot of bills be coming up starting on Friday, and we're going to be piling up with more and more legislation. So is there a way to get your legal opinion to Representative Keller before this goes to the floor?
Would we
pass it out of committee?
I'll do that too. The other is an alternative, if I might, Mr. McCullough.
Yes, Representative Keller.
If you're not locked on to Section 3 their subparagraph F. I don't, without offense, I would offer that an amendment to the committee that we delete or change line 6 to say adding a new subsection and then eliminating, deleting line 7 through 12.
Is that a motion?
As, yes, version A.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object at this time because I think while we're working on the legal opinions and trying to figure out what sideboards there may already be on here that we aren't aware of, I'm more than happy to go to Department of Law and Ledge Legal with Representative Keller and see what we can do to find out what sideboards are already on there and what more sideboards we might need to put on, and I'm more than honestly willing to work with him. I'd prefer not to do it at this time. Until we can confer
with the amendment has been withdrawn. Okay, we're back to the committee. Any further discussion? Seeing none, do we want to move this out of committee?
No.
All right. I was just checking. We'll hold this bill until Friday and have a legal opinion back on Friday, and we will see here the balance of it. We have closed public testimony. And with that, it is 2:55 p.m., and I would like to say to Chairman Gatto, it is such a pleasure to have you back here. Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.
He says it's not.